All right. Well, Daryl tells me we're back broadcasting and recording, so we'll get going. We have Xcel Energy's up for our continued discussion about the impacts of 111D, so I'll turn it over to the company.
My name is Dave Cedarquist, manager of North Dakota Regulatory Affairs for Xcel Energy. Thanks, Commission, for the opportunity to provide comments this afternoon. I guess Xcel Energy has a couple of thank you notes to write for being able to follow a couple of great presentations. So thanks, Abby and Mark, for kind of setting the stage for us. Speaking on behalf of Xcel Energy will be Nick Martins. He's our manager of environmental policy. He's been spending a lot of time in recent weeks on peeling this onion and identifying what many of the issues will be. And we do share a lot of similar concerns with what you've heard already, but there are a couple of things that he'll also highlight that perhaps might be more unique to Xcel Energy. Also assisting is Mark Nisbet. Mark's played a major role in energy issues in the state, primarily with his longstanding involvement with the North Dakota Empower Commission. So I guess without any further ado, I'll hand it over to Nick.
Just a quick question, if I could, Dave, not to cut you off right away, Nick, but I cut you off right away, right? Mark, do you have any insight on Empower, just since Dave brought that up? Is Empower looked at this at all, or are they? Or?
We had some discussions around it, and one of the effects that we had discussions around overarching energy, but still realizing that we're just putting in suggestions, and we didn't base a whole strategy on it, but I did bring it up during discussions around the wind incentives, and that we might be appreciative of having the flexibility around the renewable, and that North Dakota would still be attractive for wind projects and moving forward. But we did not set a specific 111D policy.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Thanks. All right, Nick.
All right. Thank you, Chair Koch, Commissioner Christman. I'm very much involved in trying to study and understand this rule. It's probably all that I've done since June 2nd when it appeared. As you know, we operate in 8 states, and they're all very different in terms of the goals that they've been assigned and the energy.
Can you go through, Nick, the word game of who the 8 states are?
Sure, yeah. So up here in the upper Midwest, which is mostly, you know, the perspective that I'm going to be talking from, it's Minnesota, Wisconsin, both Dakotas, and a little bit of Michigan, upper peninsula of Michigan. And then there's 2 other operating companies under Xcel Energy. One is fully within Colorado, so it has kind of a Colorado goal that's less complicated. And then one is Texas and New Mexico. So, we're trying to understand the rule from the perspective of all those states, all of which it affects somewhat differently. I'm going to speak mostly from the perspective of, the Northern States Power Operating Company, which is those 5 upper Midwest states. We have 90,000 customers about here in North Dakota. One of the things that makes us a little bit different from the other utilities is that we don't currently own any unit that we would expect to be a regulated unit under the rule here in North Dakota. Or in South Dakota, we have one gas plant that's low utilization and looks like it would be exempt. Same situation in Wisconsin. Mostly exempt units. So really, the big impact of this rule on us as an owner of generating units is in Minnesota, and how.
Can you back up? How does the purchase power agreements? Why is that not a factor?
I should have said that. It does affect us. That the owners and operators of those plants with whom we have PPAs will have the direct compliance obligation, but presumably some of the added cost would flow through PPAs to us. So that's an important qualification. I'm just talking at the first blush from the standpoint of plants we own. Okay. They're really all in Minnesota. And so how this rule affects our customers across all those states is a function of how stringent our target is in Minnesota, as you were saying, Chair Koch, and how well EPA has recognized the carbon reductions we've already made there. Certainly, we can work with all of our states to look for opportunities to do additional renewables or energy efficiency. So we are also a utility, a distribution utility. But just with that as a initial distinction, our plants are not in North Dakota. So I want to just really, we have no disagreement fundamentally with anything that's been said this morning in terms of the building blocks. We have a lot of the same concerns. I want to add a little color to that from our perspective, talk about a couple issues that haven't been discussed so much, and the fact that I won't go into, you know, building block concerns is just out of not wanting to repeat. It's not that we don't share those concerns.
I don't know. You know, it's, I'll just throw them out there as they pop up, but are you going to address how nuclear is different? Because you don't, you're the only one of our investor owns that has nuclear power.
Yeah, I could speak to that, sure. You know, excellent. Just starting with our general sort of environmental strategy. As you know, the utility industry is operating under increasingly stringent environmental regulations across the board, not only carbon, but we've been anticipating carbon regulation in some form for probably at least 10 years, maybe longer, whether that's legislative or now through EPA regulation. And, you know, our position in relation to that has been to proactively try to seek out emission reduction opportunities that are cost-effective for our customers, that ultimately protect our customers, considering both, you know, or let's say minimize the cost and risk to both customers and shareholders in view of not only today's costs that these generating resources face, but what they might face in the future. And, you know, we think it's in the best interest of customers to take that kind of proactive approach, try to do things in an orderly way, lock in competitive resources early on rather than waiting until the last minute and competing, you know, when everyone else is trying to do the same thing and maybe not being able to secure the same advantages. So we, you know, we do oppose regulations when it's necessary, but, you know, when there's a regulation in front of us, we try to work within the regulatory process, the political process, to influence that in the interests of our customers and communities and shareholders. So also a key sort of overriding priority for us has been to maintain a diverse energy portfolio so that we're not and our customers are not overly exposed to any one resource. So for the Northern States Power Company, that portfolio right now is about 36% coal, 27% nuclear, 13% natural gas, 13% wind, and 11% other renewables, biomass, hydro, very small but growing, a little bit of solar.
How do you think it'll be? Oh, go ahead.
Would you go through those again?
Yeah.
6% coal, 27% nuclear,
13% natural gas, 13% wind, 11% other renewables. So each of those, of course.
What's the impact to Xcel that you've got a higher mandate for renewable than, let's say, Otter Tail? I mean, does that come into this equation somehow? You think it must. Don't you guys have 30% because Minnesota got a little more out of you than?
That's right. We have a 30% target in Minnesota. The other utilities have a 25%. So certainly that's pushing us to do more wind, more than anything else wind. And we have, in some cases recently, we've been able to lock in wind that goes beyond our mandates just because it's a cost-competitive resource.
For the purpose of 111D, does that matter at all that you've got a different number than your other investor-owned?
It's hard to say just yet. It may be that to the extent that that's pushed us to do more renewable energy earlier, as long as we're able to get credit for that, that could help us as a utility. I'm going to come in a minute to what probably one of our biggest criticisms of this rule is that it hasn't given us much early action credit, and I'll talk about how that is. So just in terms of the functions of those, you know, having diversity, as you know, coal and nuclear are a really important low-cost baseload resource for us. Gas is both kind of an intermediate and peaking resource, but also crucial for balancing all this renewable that we're putting on the system. Renewables, besides being a low carbon resource and, you know, a good investment if we're going to face carbon regulation, is also a hedge against fuel price volatility. And as I already mentioned, you know, the newest wind projects that we have committed to, two of which will be in North Dakota, were at lower than gas price with the production tax credit and will enable us to save about $225 million for our customers in NSP over the life of those projects. So those are in a sense, good investments, whether or not this carbon regulation goes into effect.
So the this is why it's good to have different investor owns at different times, but the rate case that Mark and Dave worked so hard on a while back, that's forced you. You've agreed to build generation in North Dakota, so that's got to play into the mix that you're going to own generation during this life, during this 2030 period.
That's correct. However, any new gas plant we build will be not regulated under this rule, but under the new source rule. Now, of course, EPA has given states the option to include those into their plan, into their 111D plan. We don't know yet what decision our states will make about that. But, you know, to the extent that we have committed to build a gas plant in North Dakota over that time frame, whether that affects this rule or not will depend on that decision.
Okay. We're not letting that go, are we, Mark?
Well, and the other thing is, in North Dakota, gas plant, the carbon intensity should be an actual overall benefit in the state. So that the idea of what our goal is in North Dakota, that gas plant should fit within the framework. So.
However, if we were partnered with South Dakota, one of the goals of the partnership,
yeah,
from their perspective, would be that we're not counting it.
Yep.
So one of our real key issues with this rule, again, not repeating stuff that's been said already, but our customers in all those states have paid for these investments. We're really emphatic that they be given credit for early action, and that both through the use of a 2012 baseline and just sort of the mechanics of this methodology that's been described to you, the building blocks, the way that works is that we feel we've gotten very little credit for all the investments we've made since 2005. I'm going to illustrate this with our what we call MERP, the Metro Emission Reduction Project, and our pre-2012 wind that we've added to our system.
Were you guys surprised when that came out? Because as much lobbying as, and it's a good thing, I use that term in a positive way, that Xcel did with, I mean, with all your different jurisdictions, your 20-some senators, and I know Ben was on the Hill all the time, lobbying for that. I mean, were you surprised and you didn't get credit for that?
Honestly, yeah. I think the company was. I think that if you read the rule, there's a lot of compliments to Colorado, Minnesota, and Xcel Energy, and not a lot more than compliments.
But that was the one thing you asked for in everything,
yeah,
right? Every time you talked about credit for early action.
That's true. That's true.
So do you think, why would they change it now?
Well, that's a good question. We're pushing, you know.
You've got to put it in your comments. I get that.
We're pushing quite hard on that one. They do seem to be listening to us. We can just try. I mean, we don't know that they're going to, they could sort of give it only lip service. That's true. But just, I think it's an interesting illustration to talk about MERP and wind, because what we did through that project, $1 billion overall project, we replaced two very old coal plants, total of 652 megawatts, with
those were
Riverside and High Bridge, both right in the Twin Cities. And
those are how many megawatts?
652 together megawatts. We replaced them with 1,080 megawatts of natural gas combined cycle, so we got more megawatts out of it.
They were closed when?
2008 and 2009. They might have been closed a little bit before that, but the conversions, the gas plants were built on the same site, so the projects were both the retirement of the coal and the new gas being up and running. This was all done by 2009, so before that 2012 baseline year. We also, under that project, invested in pretty much a full overhaul of our Allen S. King plant in Stillwater, Minnesota, making it a state-of-the-art supercritical coal plant with the most advanced environmental controls. during that time frame also, between 2005 and 12, we added about 1,900 megawatts of wind to our system. So this had the following effects. Our 2012 emissions were lower because the coal had gone off our system. That gives us a more stringent target in Minnesota. We had two brand new natural gas combined cycle plants that weren't there before, to which EPA applies the 70% capacity factor target. Those combined cycle plants were operating at a relatively low capacity factor, around 25 to 30%, in part because of all the wind we installed on the system, because they balance that wind. So they have a lot of headroom between that actual capacity factor and the 70%, also contributing to a more stringent target. And finally, you know, at this refurbished coal plant, we sort of made the cost-effective available heat rate improvements, but that 6% heat rate improvement target gets applied to that plant just as to any other, where, you know, certainly at a very advanced supercritical coal plant, we can't wring out another 6%. So this is a sort of a quadruple whammy for doing the right things in terms of EPA's environmental objective. All of those things were the right things to do. All of them contribute to a more stringent Minnesota goal and sort of punishment for good deeds. So that's a big issue for us.
Why would Xcel even go? Let's go the other way. Why don't you guys just say, we've tried it with you guys, just jump on board the litigation? I mean, you guys must be looking at that too.
Well, we won't make that decision until we see the final rule. I mean, currently we're focused on comments to EPA, direct meeting with EPA, doing everything we can to influence the rule, to get positive changes to the final rule, whether that's on early action or these building block issues or stringency. But certainly we haven't put anything off the table in terms of what we might do when the rule is finalized.
Because Mark and I and Dave have talked candidly about this over the years, that I've been very critical of Xcel at times about how far ahead you guys were on trying to make the deal with the devil on some of this stuff. And then when the rules came out, they threw you under the bus. And so that's the part that I was very shocked with, how you didn't get credit for anything. And so we have to run through the process. I agree. But it is frustrating how even a company that has stepped out to try to work with them, they didn't even take care of their own, if you will, in a sense. That's a bad term, but didn't take care of the people that were trying to help them find some middle ground somewhere.
So for what a lot of people much higher than I in the company are quite frustrated.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And trying to be able to articulate your message, you mentioned these three points that you didn't feel that you're receiving adequate credit for: the Riverside and High Bridge plants being closed and replaced with natural gas, the LNS King coal plant being updated and adding how many megawatts of wind?
1,900.
1,900.
So when you take together this coal retirement type of project, the renewable energy additions and the energy efficiency programs that we've done, we've reduced CO2 emissions on the NSP system by about 23% since 2005. We're on track to reduce about 31% by 2020. So we will be 10 years early meeting EPA's stated goal for this proposal. You know, we discussed this morning, it's the 2005 goal is really, first of all, it's in terms of tons, not rate. So it's difficult to compare. You know, EPA set rate targets for the states, and different states have a different percentage reduction in rate that's required by 2030. But separately, and just sort of when you roll that all together and look at the national target, EPA says it's a 30% reduction by 2030. So had this been a program that was based on mass and based on 2005 baseline, we've done it already. Obviously, it wasn't. It's a different baseline, and it's challenging for us in some ways. So, what could be done about early action if this is one of our priorities? Obviously, an earlier baseline, a multi-year baseline that's earlier, would probably do a lot for us. If EPA is unwilling to do that, we have some sort of more targeted ideas that we think would be useful. We think that natural gas combined cycles that have been built specifically to replace coal, maybe even just on-site to replace coal, could be exempted from the building block two, from the 70% capacity factor requirement. We also think that natural gas combined cycles that are primarily designed to integrate high levels of intermittent renewable, which is what EPA wants under building block three, should have a lower target under building block two, or in some way not apply building block two, the 70% capacity factor, to all of that capacity, recognizing that it has an important role in balancing renewables. It can't really, if you operate that as a baseload in effect at 70% capacity factor, then something else, and it could be something else that emits more CO2, has to balance the renewables. So this is sort of a perverse outcome. This is something more of a targeted fix that we're working on with EPA, hoping to convince them to do something on early action if it's not simply an earlier baseline. So moving on from the early action theme, a second big concern, this has been hinted at this morning, but I want to talk a little bit more about it, is the stringency of the nearer term, in other words, not 2030, but 2020 reduction target. EPA says multiple times during the rule, they're giving states a lot of flexibility in a couple different ways. One of those ways is states do not have to do the four building blocks in exactly the same proportion as EPA used those building blocks when they derived the target. They can do less of something and more of something else, or even do things that are not part of the building blocks. And the second kind of flexibility EPA says is that you don't have to meet your interim goal until 2029. So that's a long time. You should be able to evolve your electric system over time. There's some element of truth in that flexibility. We don't want to encourage less flexibility, so that's important. But it's not really the full picture. And I think a lot of utilities are becoming more aware and more alarmed about this. Because the building blocks 1 and 2 are applied immediately in 2020, they don't ramp in gradually over time like the building blocks 3 and 4. What you have, in effect, is what if you put it on a chart, the 2012 emission rate and then the trajectory that you have to be on starting 2020, it looks like a cliff for a lot of states. It doesn't look like a sort of a gradual slope. And that is because of the way the math works. A state cannot be a whole lot above the if the target has to be met on average from 2020 to 2029, you can't be too far above in 2020 and still catch up in 2029. And even though you have flexibility to do other things, because each of the building blocks is pretty aggressive individually, if you don't do them or you delay action and only do things outside the four building blocks, you really can't get there for many of the states. You can't. That target is so much lower and so immediate that what we have is a very stringent 2020 target. Now that's as little as in the most extreme case, 6 months after a state plan would be approved by EPA. Depending on what a state does and the extensions that it applies for, it might be more like a year, year and a half, 2 years. But it's a very short amount of time after a state plan is approved that utilities and states have to have made a very stringent target. Sorry, a very big reduction, a very stringent goal. And it's not obvious how you would get there. One of the most obvious things that is not a building block measure is retiring plants. And so we're very concerned that this kind of cliff problem or this stringent 2020 target could result in forced retirements, a lot of stranded costs, rate impacts, reliability impacts. So
could you just take a second back?
Yeah.
Trying to put myself in your boardroom, trying to figure out how you look at this, where I can visualize like how MDU sits around, they think about the states they operate in, and same with Otter Tail, but for you, with the states that you operate in, are you viewing this as like three different regions, or is this one? I mean, how do you even begin to look at what you might want to get as a company? Or can you put all your states in one big region?
It's an interesting balance. It is three different operating companies that functionally operate separate from each other.
Well, I think NSP, that's the best way to think of what you're talking perhaps for us.
That's right. I mean, I think we have to have, to some extent, we have to have uniform positions across Xcel Energy, three different operating companies. To some extent, there can be differences in our positions, but we have to figure out what works best for NSP, which is a challenge in itself because the different states within NSP have different goals, different
Michigan,
views of this rule.
Right away, right?
Yes.
But I should be talking to those commissioners over there, too, if that's something that a regional plan, you probably would want them in it.
There would be, intuitively, there's advantages to a regional plan. For a multi-state utility like us that can manage a portfolio for finding the cost-effective reduction opportunities, we're not ready to say until we see the final rule, you know, we should do a regional plan or we shouldn't. And as has already been mentioned, the big differences between the targets make stand as a pretty significant obstacle to regional plans as well. So that's challenging.
But is there any way that you see that, well, once again, trying to put words in your mouth, but Colorado would be a lower priority probably than Michigan and Wisconsin of North Dakota ever working with them, or you think they would come into the mix too? They're physically closer, perhaps, but...
Yeah. Theoretically, EPA hasn't set any limitations on whether states that could contribute in a regional program would have to be adjacent. I mean, there's logic to them being in the same power pool and, you know, adjacent states perhaps, but that's not actually required. So theoretically, states that have, for example, a mass budget and combine that and then trade allowances or something could be non-adjacent states. That's right. Just to finish the point about, this stringent 2020 target, because I don't want to just sort of raise problems without suggesting a solution. We think the best solution to this is for the EPA to defer entirely to the states on setting a glide path to the 2030 target. So in other words, the 2030 goal is the environmental objective. How you get there, the states will be much better able to sort of look at their electric systems, find out a reasonably smooth trajectory. As long as they can demonstrate to EPA that they will achieve the 2030 target, EPA should not have to set binding interim goals. Now, we don't know if EPA would accept that. If EPA would not accept that, there are some other ways you could look at this. You could say, ramp in over time building blocks 1 and 2, gradually, like building blocks 3 and 4, so that you give more realistic time frame to do these things, and that would turn that from looking like a cliff into looking more like a slope to 2030. So that's our primary position and fallback position on this sort of cliff issue.
Nick, can you tell me how the 2020 goal might result in forced early retirements? Walk through that.
Well, I think that if your state has a 2020 goal that is drastically below your current emission rate, and you can't actually, even though nominally there's this flexibility to do other things and to take time, if in effect the reality of it is you've got a very stringent goal and you can't actually ramp your natural gas plants up to 70% because you don't have the gas supply or you don't have the transmission access or something, and you can't do 6% heat rate improvements, or you know, you stack up all these things that add up to the goal, but you don't actually have many options to get there. What's left is to retire a coal plant and meet the target in that way. And so that means instead of having sort of a less disruptive step down that the state might design over as long as they get to the 2030 target, if they just have this cliff, they don't have a lot of options. And there's some states who have looked into the EPA modeling of what happens in a compliance scenario that see most or all of their coal plants retiring in 2020, because that's the way the target, that's what happens in the electricity system when you set it at that level. So that would, I mean, you've heard plenty this morning about, you know, early retirements and stranded costs and all that kind of thing.
So along that line, what coal plants have you retired in the last 10 years, and then what plants do you foresee retiring in the next 15 years?
Well, we have retired, as I mentioned already, High Bridge and Riverside. We have a couple of coal units at a plant called Black Dog in Burnsville outside Minneapolis that are already slated for retirement next year, driven by the mercury rule.
Is that the whole facility, or is that a coal
that's the last of
out of
no that's the last of the coal at that facility, because some of the coal units were already converted to gas or retired earlier. And we have a very small biomass plant up in northern Wisconsin that still burns some coal in one of the boilers that will be going to gas, again, for mercury rule compliance. Beyond that, we have, there's a lot of push from some environmental advocates and others in Minnesota for us to retire units at Sherco, which is our biggest facility. We don't have any current retirement dates set, and we're trying to figure that out. But so I guess beyond these relatively small units that are slated for retirement next year for mercury rule compliance, we don't have any scheduled coal retirements at this time.
Those three will all be in 15.
Yes.
And Sherco has, you've invested a lot of money there recently, correct, in the Sherco plants?
We've invested on an ongoing basis. We are faced with the kind of thing that's been described here for Big Stone faces Sherco in the future, because there are regional haze and visibility lawsuits impacting that plant that could point to either installing selective catalytic reduction or retiring the plant. And so we're trying to figure out the best route forward there.
What's the time frame on that?
The earliest we would have to retire or add those SCRs is mid-2020s. Mm. But for regional haze rule or visibility rule compliance. And, you know, does this carbon rule change that picture? It's hard to say yet because, you know, there is some flexibility. We don't know how Minnesota will approach its plan, how much of a reduction obligation they would assign to us versus other utilities, whether we can get there through more renewables and keep operating Sherco units as they are. That's all sort of still up in the air. So we haven't, you know, I don't know that retirement of Sherco units 1 and 2 is more or less likely under this rule, but there are other drivers pushing that as well.
Certainly wouldn't be less likely. I mean, under your scenario, it wouldn't be less likely under this rule.
Right. You're right.
Okay.
When were the other Black Dog units retired?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I can find that out.
In the last few years. It's like some way back, or
it's also probably pre 2012. So it's also part of the in that way similar to MERP, where these are reductions that have been made that are sort of not given full credit.
You think it's since 2005, though?
Yes.
And how many units were there that are already retired?
I don't want to hazard a guess. I need to look that up. I'm sorry, Commissioner.
I think there were five or six units at one time there. And now we're down to the one unit remaining, I believe.
Yeah, okay.
So the only thing, I think, as I said before, a lot of these building block concerns and the fact that EPA has not really examined the interaction between building blocks, you've heard about that already. That's a concern we share. Certainly if you add a lot of renewable energy and you redispatch gas and push down the coal utilization, you're going to get a worse heat rate, other things like that. But I won't dwell on that. You've already heard about that. I do want to mention kind of an overriding concern about EPA implementing this sort of far-reaching energy strategy through the Clean Air Act. And this concern kind of operates on two levels. You know, we've said many times that decisions like this are really best made through well-designed national legislation covering multiple sectors. The Clean Air Act is a really poor mechanism for climate policy. It's the mechanism we have, so right now we're focused on, you know, we don't know whether it will survive legal challenge as it is, but we're focused on doing what we can to improve it and reduce the cost to our customers. So that's the first level of sort of how you should make policy. The second level is, I think, more of a jurisdictional concern. If we're looking at reductions that can only be made through changing the dispatch approach or dispatch order, renewable energy and energy efficiency, and anything that is included as a reduction measure in a state plan becomes federally enforceable. Clearly, we have EPA coming into what's been the jurisdiction of public service commissions, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and regional transmission organizations. And so we, in our comments, I am sure that we're going to remind EPA that they should respect the authority of states through their utility commissions and air regulatory agencies to make energy policy in the states. That's an important point for us.
You brought up the FERC, and of course Tony Clark used to work here, and he's been very vocal about this, but I suppose the FERC doesn't take a position as long as the administrations all line up. I mean, the current FERC is not going to take a position on this as long as the current guy's in the White House, right? I mean, the FERC would be the natural people who would step out and say this is wrong, but they're all in the same administration. I mean, that's fair to assume, right?
I guess so, yeah.
That's what the chairman said recently.
Exactly.
So just to close, I think that, you know, it's hard for us to predict this early what rate impacts or cost impacts this may have on our customers in North Dakota. we, as I started by saying, we don't have, you know, directly affected facilities here. We do have PPAs with facilities. We do have the ways in which the rule impacts us on in Minnesota could flow through to our North Dakota customers. Thus, it's important that we get more reasonable treatment in Minnesota and get more early action credit in Minnesota. We're happy to, you know, work with this commission and our other commissions on ways that we can, you know, look for cost-effective ways for North Dakota to meet its goal through renewables or energy efficiency, if those are things that the state wants to pursue. And we think that some of those investments may turn out to be kind of no-regrets actions that make sense for North Dakotans, regardless whether this rule, you know, is finalized at all or is finalized as proposed. So I think that's all I have for now. I'm happy to take more questions.
That whole restack we're going through right now with generation, that's got to tie into this mix pretty heavily, too.
Do you want to speak to that? Sure.
I guess the way I would characterize that, Commissioner, is that the proposed rules will probably create more potential for resource decisions that impact states differently or that states don't agree on. And so it's just going to sort of exacerbate the issue a little bit by creating more of a potential for that to occur. So I guess the restack effort then needs, it actually complicates it, makes it more complicated, but perhaps also more useful if you can get to a point of a workable restack protocol. But that's kind of at this point in time how I would characterize that interplay.
Reliability. You have reliability concerns as a company on what you may be forced to do?
Yes, I think we do. I think, again, it's hard to say, to, you know, this particular unit is going to retire, and, you know, that's a few steps down the line. But it, you know, stepping back at a more general level, we think these, you know, these rules are fundamentally going to change the way dispatch is done, and are going to push some big decisions. They could push retirements. They could have reliability impacts. They reshuffle the way that we're used to balancing a lot of intermittent renewable with natural gas, and you know, it's hard to sort of say exactly how that's gonna play out. But we would, you know, have some concerns about that.
What about the nuclear piece? We brought it up briefly. How does that play into this at all? Could,
right.
Southern Company was up here just last week, and they're building some nuke plants around the country right now. I mean, can we build another nuclear plant somewhere?
So let me talk a little bit about how nuclear is treated in the rule, because it's quite confusing. In fact, nobody seems to like it, and EPA sort of feels like I think they've heard that, and I'm not sure what they're thinking of doing. But the way existing nuclear – we have about 1,700 megawatts, three units in Minnesota. And the way existing nuclear is treated in the rule, EPA looked at a sort of a general nationwide – study from the Energy Information Administration and said it looks like about 6% of the nationwide nuclear capacity is at risk of retirement because of the challenging economics these days. And we think this rule will help change the financial incentives and preserve those plants. So what they have done is, because I don't want to actually, it's hard to describe, I'm not sort of defending this logic because I don't fully understand it, but because nuclear, because the rule is giving an advantage to nuclear plants, we think states are going to do that. So we're also going to put it, we being EPA, is also going to put that nuclear generation into the state goal, into the denominator. So what they've done is taken that 6% of nuclear capacity. They haven't done any state-by-state look at what plants are actually at risk. They've just said, if you've got nuclear capacity in your state, we'll multiply it by 6%. We'll multiply that by 90% because we'll assume nuclear plants are operated around 90% capacity factor, which is okay, you know, more or less. And then we'll take those megawatt hours, put them in the denominator of the state goal, and they make the state goal more stringent just by having nuclear plants in your state. Mm. Now, when you come around, when you come to showing achievement of the goal or compliance with the goal, we think the rule is not as clear as one would like, but we think that you'll be able to take that same 6% and count it for compliance. So it's sort of a wash at best, as long as you don't retire the plants. But, you know, I think a lot of people with nuclear plants feel, well, you know, don't penalize us for having nuclear, a carbon-free resource in our state. Don't make it part of the goal, but make it a compliance option. And then if we build new nuclear, on that the rule is not ambiguous. If you build new nuclear, if you do uprates, that can help you achieve the goal. That counts, okay? But we have some nuclear plants that are slated for retirement just because of license expiration after 2030. When that happens, you know, our carbon emissions are going to jump unless we find carbon-free resources to replace them, or unless we replace them with new natural gas that is outside the rule. Carbon emissions go up. That doesn't seem to be what EPA wants either. So we think that EPA needs to do something to give a stronger incentive to keep nuclear, which is an important carbon-free resource for us, and you know that there are. I'm sure there are some fixes that can be made to do that, and EPA may be amenable to that.
Okay. How much wind generation do you have in North Dakota right now?
What have you guys?
12 megawatts of power purchase right now, and then those 350 that we're talking about with the contracts that we're hoping will be completed by the end of next year.
So about 360 roughly.
Yeah, it would be at that
point. So are in your planning and in Minnesota's planning, are you assuming that that's going to count as Minnesota's renewable production or ours?
We can't assume that yet either way. I mean, the it's clear that in terms of goal setting, the renewables that are in a state are put in the denominator of a state's goal and make it more stringent. There's nowhere in the rule that clearly says for compliance, credit will go to the state that where the load is that that's serving. We have heard from EPA, you know, verbally that that's the way they're leaning, but they haven't made that clear. So we don't know exactly how, you know, that's really not something that we'll be able to decide. That's something that the responsible agencies in each of the states will have to, or that EPA, maybe they're hearing enough that they'll make it more clear in the final rule. I don't know.
What will be your recommendation to the EPA, though, in your comments?
I don't know that we have one as yet. We want to work with our commissions to find a fair resolution to this. It's difficult for us to have a single position on that because we have got a stringent goal in Minnesota. But we serve the Dakotas. We serve South Dakota, where this is a serious issue, you know, that they've got a very stringent goal as well and a lot of exported renewable energy. So we see that the asymmetry of it, both the asymmetry within renewable energy between goal setting and compliance and the asymmetry between fossil emissions and renewable or fossil resource exported fossil and exported renewables as really big problems that have not been solved yet. But I don't know that we have a single position because we're operating across states that are differently affected by this.
Do you think it's realistic, as I understood your idea about if the EPA just set that target at the end and let each state work out their own situation, you know, states that are really in a bind the way the proposal is currently laid out, like South Dakota, without federal intervention, do you think there's any chance that other states are just going to come up and help them absorb their dilemma and make up for that?
No, I don't see any reason why a state would sort of volunteer to help another state, especially if they've got a goal that's less stringent. I think that another thing that EPA has said is that for a state plan to be approvable, there can't be double counting of anything in another state. So I don't know how, if two states just can't agree and both submit a state plan claiming credit for renewables in one of those states, I don't know how EPA works that out.
It may make a fib. It may forget all about the states.
Well, yeah. I mean, and as long as a state submits a plan, EPA has to consider it. But that's true. I guess they could call that an unapprovable plan and do it.
Just a point of clarification, Commissioner Crisman was asking about Black Dog. There are originally four coal units on that campus. Units 1 and 2 were converted in 2002 with a Unit 5 natural gas unit. And then Units 3 and 4 are going to be converted to a natural gas Unit 6 sometime in the future. That's our plan anyway. So the remaining two coal units total 290 megawatts.
Thank you.
Julie, do you have any follow-up? No. Dave, I'll give you the last word. Okay. All right, well, do you gentlemen have anything at all? I guess, is this covered up? When are your comments going to go in, you guess? Guesstimate, October 15th? Again?
I'm sure that we'll have a lot of layers of review that...
Okay, well, no, thank you very much, and you bring out some really good points about a lot of things, so appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think we have down GRE's next in the queue. Had GRE, Mincota, and Basin, just so what I had written down. Basin, you got to go last because that's what Dale wanted, so. Okay, we keep going for a break. Okay. You're not bringing Al up here as backup?
Well, I asked him, and
he didn't want to.
Okay.
Well, good afternoon, commissioners. I am Mary Jo Roth. I'm the environmental manager for Great River Energy. Based in our offices in Maple Grove, Minnesota. Thanks for making it a nice day for travel. I really would like to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity for Great River Energy to come and provide some input to the state on this clean power plan. I will say that we're probably different from every other utility that you've heard of today in the sense that, so we do have facilities in both Minnesota and North Dakota. However, all of our facilities in Minnesota are not considered affected facilities. So our focus really is on North Dakota, its goal, and our three coal plants in North Dakota. Of course,
why they're not affected facilities? I maybe not connected.
Because they're simple cycle combustion turbines.
All simple. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. And we have one RDF facility as well. We also don't have any retail in North Dakota, as you're also aware. So we're in a little bit different situation. As we look at the Clean Power Plan, I would say that our guiding principle is to ensure that we have reliable and affordable energy for our members that we serve in Minnesota. And as others have said, we've been expecting there would be CO2 regulations for some time now. Consequently, we chose to put ourselves in the position of trying to manage the business risk associated with CO2. And we've taken a number of steps over the years. We've done a lot to reduce the heat rate at some of our facilities. We have also installed dry fining, which I'm sure you are somewhat familiar with. But also, in July of last year, our board of directors decided to pass a resolution. And that resolution does a number of things, but probably what's of interest here is that we decided to accelerate the depreciation on both Coal Creek and Stanton stations so that rather than a typical 30-year appreciation period, we will fully depreciate both of those units in 15 years by 2028. And we think that what this does is it provides us with more options and allows us to be better prepared to manage the regulatory uncertainty around this rule. Now, having said that, I really want to emphasize we have absolutely no plans to retire any of those units. In fact, we intend to continue to operate all of our units and on top of that add our Spiritwood station starting in November of this year as well.
See, that's the question I should have asked MDU this morning when I was fishing around trying to figure out what the life of those plants is. It's when they're depreciated out fully is what I was trying to get to. But when how much of an increase in cost when you depreciate that out quicker? Is it like 3-4% a year to customers? Because if you're going to depreciate it quicker, it's got to cost more. Just the swag.
Yeah, I don't have a good swag. I mean, honestly, I'm not going to try to guess at something that I can't answer. So in light of the fact that we have decided to try to manage the business risk to GRE, we have also felt that it was very important for us to engage in conversations with EPA to try to get this final rule to be something that we can better live with. And to that end, we have engaged through a couple of coalitions and also a stakeholders group. And these coalitions both have very good access to EPA. So we feel like some of our ideas and thoughts that we're putting forth through the coalitions are at least falling on the right ears at EPA. Obviously, we can't control what EPA is going to do with those ideas. But as I said, our guiding principle through all of this is that we maintain reliability and affordability of energy to our members. So looking at North Dakota's situation, we do think that North Dakota comes out quite favorably in the rule, and this, of course, is relative to the other states. There's 49 affected states, and, of course, North Dakota's target is the lowest intensity among them. We think that having an intensity-based goal for North Dakota rather than a mass-based goal is also advantageous because North Dakota is and will be continuing to see significant growth in coming years. And so what we feel is important is to provide our comments to EPA, try to get some of the corrections made, and try to deal with some of the issues with the proposed rule, and some of them you, of course, have already heard today. But at the same time, working hard to make sure that North Dakota's goal is not increased from the 10.6% to something higher and something less reasonable. Great River Energy, like I say, we've been concerned about CO2 regulation for some time, and we have taken a number of steps to reduce our intensity in North Dakota. I've already mentioned dry fining. And I do want to say that this technology has worked out very well for us. Overall, we've seen a 4% CO2 reduction from our Coal Creek Station units. Over time, because of other heat rate improvements that we've made as well, we've seen a 6% reduction, heat rate reduction on one unit at Coal Creek Station and a 9% on the other. What I'd like to offer today is that our dry fining technology is available for others, and we'd be happy to talk to others about installing that technology.
So to put a very fine point on it, you're saying if they come use dry fining, they can get to 6%.
Well, that's very close to what we have found, yes.
Does that work for all coal types?
It would work, of course, better for lower grade coals like lignite. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'll be the kind of questions for those in the room that you're going to get asked right away. Why can't you do that? And lay out why you can or can't do it. I can see that coming.
But good. Okay. I guess just a couple things I wanted to point out, too. Coal Creek and Stanton are currently the most efficient plants in North Dakota, so they have been able to bring their CO2 emissions down. We are still evaluating other actions. We recognize that there's probably other things we may be able to cost-effectively do with respect to heat rate. Our Spiritwood station, which I mentioned, is going to be coming online in November. That's a combined heat and power facility. And it was not in the 2012 baseline. But once we bring it online, it will become part of the compliance plan. And because the emissions is lower than North Dakota's target, both their interim goal and their 2030 goal as well, that would contribute to North Dakota's reduction. One concern that we do have, I guess like Excel and perhaps others too, is that there is no credit for early action. And we feel that we have done an awful lot to reduce our emissions since 2005. And so we, part of our comments to EPA will be to give some credit for early actions. I know that one of the questions you asked earlier was whether or not there is a need for a regional compliance strategy. And, you know, before the rule was proposed, when we had no idea what it was going to look like, we actually initiated this concept, this idea of a regional approach. You'd be working with your RTOs, your ISOs, to accomplish that. And what was rather unique about this market-based approach, aside from it being fairly efficient and cost-effective, it would return the carbon fees directly to the consumers, different from a carbon tax situation, for example. And we still think that that's a very good plan. However, now that the rule has come out and we see where North Dakota fares relative to the other 48 states, we no longer think that North Dakota should have to use a regional approach to reach its target. The other thing I will say about a regional approach is I think it is going to be very, very challenging to construct and implement for that matter. So some of the outstanding issues for us.
Do you have any ideas? Okay, I get your point. You got one generation, it's all here. It's a state's easy. But do you have any thoughts that if we would do a state-only approach, how you would maybe solve some of those challenges that have been brought out this morning?
Yeah, and isn't that an excellent question? I sat down with a couple folks from the health department a couple weeks ago, and I don't have a good answer for you, but what I can say is maybe it makes some sense for the utilities to get together and at least start this dialogue and just see as we talk among ourselves if there's ways that we can make this happen.
I would say to GRE that, you know, you've got an idea that works well, but we need help to solve these problems. If we can figure out a state plan only, that's fine by me. But then to go back to the cost to impact other customers in other jurisdictions, how we would, or to our customers because of what's in other jurisdictions, if there's a way to break plants out where third to third to third and you can somehow do it, okay. But that's a part, if GRE wants us to do it, I'd seriously look at it, but help us answer those questions.
Yeah.
We got a lot of good folks out there that know a lot of things about this that would be helpful.
Good. And we are very willing to do that and would like to get this dialogue going.
Sure.
The wind energy credit has already been mentioned. And, you know, it's not clear who is going to end up getting credit for wind and other renewables. But I do think it's fairly clear that North Dakota is going to have something more than just a goal in place. They're going to have a, a mandate in place for renewables. So I would imagine that's something
that.
I think for purposes of enforceability in the state implementation plan, I think that there's going to have to be some type of a more than just the state goal that North Dakota has right now, but rather an actual mandated plan.
So if we have a SIP at some point in time, then you think there has to be a number tied to that so we can enforce it. That makes sense.
Yes.
That's a big change in the state.
It is.
But we're already way in excess of it.
Why does that matter if the reality is you've got way more than what you...
Because there's the two sides. One was how the building blocks were constructed in the first place for purpose of establishing the goal. But on the other side, there is compliance. And so to the extent that North Dakota goes beyond 15%, they'll be able to use renewables in their compliance strategy.
And if a plant is up and running and you selling power to the grid, that isn't proof enough that the goal is being met or exceeded? I mean, what more compliance? What does a, you know, line in our session code that says we have to have 20%? How does that make that somehow stronger from an enforcement standpoint?
Well, maybe I don't have the perfect answer, but I would imagine that in order for EPA to approve a state plan, they're going to want to see some type of mandate that ensures that utilities and the state are meeting that goal.
Jerry Land's going to talk. E.F. Hutton.
If we submit a state plan that does not give us 15% energy efficiency approved, we don't do any of that, but our plan still meets our goal, it should be approved, right?
Yes, assuming the components of the plan are what EPA deems enforceable, yes. Mm-hmm.
So if our goal, if our plan was to add 1,000 megawatts of wind and sell it all to Minnesota, and we take credit for the wind, well, then the plan should be approved. Our rate went down.
Well, and this one person sitting here doesn't have all the answers by any means.
Yeah,
but it would just seem to me that EPA is going to require something in their minds that makes it more enforceable. I guess that's a question to be answered.
And if they don't approve our plan, what's the problem with that? What are they going to do?
They will come up with a federal implementation plan.
There will be a plan.
Yeah.
Whether it's state or federal. If the state, and the enforceability end of it, the way I look at it is that there has to be some hammer there, like we have in our permits, that if a plant doesn't meet their compliance limits, there's a hammer there that the state can step in and say, you got to meet those emission targets or those emission limits. And so they're going to look very closely at the elements of the plan and how enforceable they are. And what are the punitive measures that can be taken if an entity doesn't meet the endpoint? That's a question that states are asking, is federal enforceability. That's a big one for the states. And how is EPA defining that for 111D? And we're still seeking that answer.
You know, Dave, not to prejudge anything here, but what you're talking about is what's in my mind as this whole thing's going on is that at some point in time we'll have to decide what the three of us want to do in our comments. The comment could be as simply as, this is state jurisdiction, leave me alone, and then let that play out. I mean, I've heard my colleagues in different parts of the state, not just Republican, saying that's their comments.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would be your reaction to that if we said, you know what, this is state jurisdiction, leave us alone?
My reaction was to tell EPA to go talk to you guys.
I mean,
because that is a very real scenario.
Have you heard your counterparts talking about that around the country?
Well, the concern is that the state environmental agency would go through all this work through all of the process, and it gets to the utilities commission. They're just going, that does not meet.
Thank you for your input.
Yeah, our mandate. We can't go along with this. Then what do we do?
Right.
And so that's where this. This is the first time we've had this much interaction between the various agencies, so this is new territory for us. And so I don't have answers to those questions.
But you know, when we went through the sulfur rules, how would those have been different? I mean, the Clean Air Act came out and said this has to be reduced by so much, and Julie just said it's a different science, right? That's the big difference here, right? It's then it was enforceable. The regulators were on board because you could tie it back to something, and there was time. I mean, it's all those same things about technology, right?
Yeah, it's kind of the same but different. We're dealing with the Regional Haze Program. We dealt with direct emission limits on the stack out of the plant. We're dealing with other issues here, like efficiencies in the boilers. We're dealing with redispatch of electricity to lower emitting units. We're dealing with renewable energy and then demand-side energy efficiency. These are programs that have never been addressed under the Clean Air Act before. So it is quite different. But the end point is the same, but quite different approach to get there.
Well, we got a long ways to go today in our discussions, but the more we sit here today, I think about everything you're talking about in these building blocks, that's our rate cases. That's why would I give that up to the feds? Anyway, I digress again.
Okay. Well, so I'm kind of at a conclusory point here, actually. I guess maybe the last thing I would mention is the interim goals conundrum, which Nick Martin from Excel talked about quite well. We really do see a need for there to be more of a graduated compliance path, and we really do feel that it should be up to the states to figure out what that path looks like and how they're going to get to their 2030 goal. Those are all my remarks. I guess I might conclude by saying, to the extent Jerry can help, we're here, and and we're ready to do what we can.
When are you filing your comments?
Well, that is a great question. I had thought October 16th. However, there's a lot of internal discussion around this and concern around this. And so I think there's actually going to be presentations made to our senior staff and even our board prior to October 16th. So I would imagine we'll have our at least an outline of our comments sooner than that.
When our role with GRE is much different than it was with the previous three guests, it's right. Just trying to understand what all the opportunities are. So.
Right.
Randy, anything else?
Yeah, I'm out of battery here.
We've been talking to most of
them. When you say things like needing more gradual increase, or when you talked about the potential for other companies to use your dry fine technology, do you think that that's good policy, that this is important, that if we somebody's consumers have to pay for all of those things, so is it worth it to put that cost on someone's consumers in order to accomplish the kinds of carbon reductions that I talked about at the very onset? Do you really think that that's good policy, or is that just something that would be a little bit beneficial to your company but is still bad policy?
Well, here's maybe how I look at it. If, in fact, CO2 regulation is going to go forward in some manner, in some way, and we don't know, of course, what that end result is going to be, but if you assume that there is going to be some CO2 regulation, I'd say there is no question, I doubt anyone would argue with the fact that it is going to cost something. So if dry fining turns out to be a more effective, cost-effective way to reduce emissions, then I would think that would be something utilities would want to consider.
If we in the industry, if you in the industry, start turning in comments that are positive about some parts of this and operate under the assumption that some regulation is going to happen, despite the fact that in the last month, Australia got rid of theirs, seeing what a disaster it was, doesn't that just provide all the more momentum for those kinds of regulations that I think a lot of people in the room are right now sitting here thinking are pretty silly?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, because there is an overlying legal component to all of this. I mean, we've seen the U.S. Supreme Court uphold in Massachusetts versus EPA that greenhouse gases must be regulated if, in fact, they are found to endanger human health and the environment. And I feel that some of what's going to be required is actually going to end up coming out of the courts unless, for example, Congress steps in and changes things. So it isn't that our comments would be to the effect that we necessarily support the regulations, but rather to the effect that based on the proposal that's been made, here are the issues that we have with that.
Thank you.
Mary Jo, can you talk at all about how your proposed coalition suggestions work with this? I mean, is it even, you threw those out there before you had any sense of where they were going to come down. Is it still relevant, and would it be a workable way to get to these goals, or is it going in the heap pile?
Can I ask for a little more of a clarification? I'm sorry. I think
the
I
group,
didn't understand
we sat down and heard your sort of market-based approach. Does that work with these rules?
Yes, it would still work with these
rules. It would.
Absolutely, yes. You know, that concept is a type of a regional or multi-state approach. It's going to have just as many challenges as probably any other multi-state compact would have, but it would definitely still work under this proposed rule.
Would it just sort of throw the building blocks out the window and you just achieve the goals through your generation mix entirely, or
no? I think.
I mean, how is energy efficiency addressed in that?
Yeah, I think it would just become a component. I don't know that you would expect that concept to be the entire answer for how utilities or states would have to meet their goals. I still think it would be just a component of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Andy, follow up?
Yeah, if I understood your comment earlier, you said that North Dakota is affected less because this is intensity-based and not mass-based. So what kind of states or regions would benefit from if they did a mass-based proposal instead of intensity-based?
Well, I guess the inverse of the benefit of an intensity-based standard for a state with growth would be a mass-based for a state that isn't seeing much growth, if any.
So the states that are struggling economically are probably filing comments that they should switch to a mass-based approach? Is that logical?
That's kind of a sweeping statement. I can't say what states are going to be doing.
If that happened and they switched to a mass-based approach, then would Spiritwood, instead of being helping and being part of North Dakota's solution, it would add to the problem?
Well, I guess it would come out to what North Dakota's mass-based number is, and the whole conversion from an intensity-based goal to a mass-based goal is very, very non-understood. We have even asked EPA to help us understand how you might convert from intensity to mass-based, and they do not have a good answer. So it's kind of hard to answer that question without understanding what, you know, what a mass-based goal for North Dakota would look like.
So once we get past October 16th and all the comments come in, if they made that one change, it basically confuses this whole thing so much that we don't know where we'd stand anymore.
Yeah, we'd have to evaluate for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
One more time. Dave, I always give you the last word. Well, thank you, Mary Jo. Anything else?
Thank you. Oh, you have none, David? Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate this.
Okay. Well, let's keep rolling here. If I know people might have to slip in and out to do their business, but Minkota, you guys are up. What else we got? Ooh. And we were just up there yesterday for a power line dedication.
We appreciate that you came to the eastern side of the state, and we're pleased.
Are they still talking about Commissioner Crispin's comments?
Yes, it's all of the buzz. Yes.
People were Twittering and tweeting and all that
That's
other
right.
stuff.
I think the buzz was those cookies and brownies and stuff, and we're wondering why the leftovers weren't brought along. Or apparently they got cleaned up.
That's right. Well, as a cooperative, we also work cooperatively on that, so the Minkota employees took care of the rest of that this morning.
I would offer up, too, if it's okay with you folks, if there's any of the co-ops that belong to Minkota, you're certainly welcome. I saw Scott out there somewhere.
Sure.
If that's okay with you guys, to
sure.
Scott, yeah. You might as well come up too, because I'm sure you came out here for some thoughts too. And if that's okay with Stacey, you guys.
Well, thank you again for having all of the utilities present today. Minkota is a generation and transmission cooperative owned by 11 member owner distribution cooperatives, Cass County being one of our member owners. We serve approximately 134,000. Members on the eastern third of North Dakota and northwest Minnesota. Minkota also serves as an operating agent for the Northern Municipal Power Agency. Those are 12 associated municipal electrics in the same geographic area as Minkota. Minkota operates two coal-fired EGUs in North Dakota, out at the Milton R. Young Station, that between the two units is approximately 700 megawatts of coal-fired energy. And we also have approximately 30% share in the Coyote Station in Beulah. In addition to our lignite resources, Minkota has approximately 9% of our system capacity comprised of hydroelectric power, so we have a WAPA allocation as well. We are.
Is that forever, Stacey? I mean, do you get that for as long as the water flows, or does that have to be renewed or something?
Yeah, as far as I know, there are no plans to revisit those contracts, but in terms of an expiration date, I'm not aware of if there is one. So We also are a leader in wind power. So in 2010, Minn Kota Power was named the Department of Energy's Wind Cooperative of the Year. And wind energy comprises approximately one-third of our system resources. So on a per capita basis, we are the leader in G&T cooperatives, specifically relating to wind energy. So altogether, between our hydroelectric power, which for purposes of the carbon rule is not counted, so I want to be clear about that. But so you have a perspective of our resources. About over 40% come from non-carbon-based resources, and then we use lignite to fuel the vast majority of the remaining resources. So despite that significant investment in wind energy that I mentioned, our carbon rate is still higher than the target EPA has set even for that initial 2020 interim goal. The rule is so complex in nature, and I certainly won't revisit many of the comments that have been made this morning, but we're continuing to review the impact to Minn Kota and our member owners.
What is your carbon rate, Stacy?
It's right in that 2,000.
We're right about 2,000 pounds per megawatt hour.
So we are reviewing an entire range of scenarios, making assumptions, whether it's 1%, 2% heat rate improvement, whether we get to keep all of the wind credit in North Dakota. We're really trying to evaluate the entire range of options and assumptions so that we can properly assess what the impact to our members are. We're not ready to make those figures public because they still are under review, but under many of those scenarios there will be certainly a cost, probably a significant cost impact to our member owners. We have additional concerns that were mentioned this morning regarding the time available for comment on the rule. Even with that October deadline and that lengthened comment period time, because of the complexity of the rule, we expect we'll need all of that in order to adequately form our comments. Who gets credit for renewable energy is certainly an issue. And then our environmental manager, John Graves, I'm sorry, I failed to introduce you earlier, can maybe talk a little bit more about that assumption of the 6% heat rate improvement.
Well, I don't think that Minn Kota is in any different position than what the other utilities have said. The 6% heat rate improvement has generally been acknowledged as extremely challenging. Minn Kota has, like most operators, has made previous improvements at the plant. We've done the things such as, you know, replacing turbine rotors to those types of things. We've replaced our digital control systems. So there isn't really much left there. We're looking at that, trying to put costs to that. You know, like most companies, maybe there's 1 or 2%, but at what cost? The low-hanging fruit, so to speak, has been previously picked.
John, how would you react to the, you know, previous Jerry talked about the 6% with dry fining? I mean, could you use dry fining, and would it?
We're a cyclone-fired unit, and dry fining is more appropriate and applicable to PC-fired units. On a cyclone-fired unit, we do have a pre-dry system to remove moisture from the coal before it enters the cyclones. So that technology really just is not applicable in our particular case, although they've done great things with it for their facility.
Coyote is also cyclone?
That is correct. And their facility is very similar to ours, as is Leland Dole's too. Those three facilities are not exactly the same, but they're very close.
The commission also requested that the companies provide input as to whether multi-state compacts are certainly advisable, or whether we would suggest that format. From our perspective, we don't think, and certainly I don't even think that today, there's been a suggestion that it would reduce costs for North Dakota to enter into that type of format. So from our perspective, from a cost basis, we certainly wouldn't recommend that type of format going forward. Again, not knowing what that final rule looks like.
Jay Stacy, how about your national organization? What you must be doing something. The national organizations have to be weighing in heavily.
That's correct. And I think the national association is doing what it can, because by our nature, we are rural, and we have fewer members per mile of line, so the costs impact our rural electric members differently than they do with investor-owned utilities. That said, there is an entire range of impacts, and every state, as many of the utilities talked about this morning, the impacts are so different from state to state. So the NRECA, I know, has come out in opposition to this rule. There's a work John's involved in on the environmental side to react specifically and to formulate comments.
If I could just expound on that a little bit.
Maybe the regional difference is what you might see. That'd be interesting to get your viewpoint on that.
Well, in the co-op family, obviously, in the western part of the United States has a higher percentage of coal-fired units than some of the utilities co-ops in other areas. But overall, co-ops generally have more coal-fired units than do IOUs. And here again, though, there's also a mix of fuels that go along with that. And depending upon the part of the country they're from, what renewables they may have on their system varies extensively, simply because in North Dakota we have more opportunity for renewables in the form of wind than some of the other states as well. So it is a broad mix there, and as to how they're impacted there. But generally speaking, you know, I haven't heard anybody who's in favor, obviously, of this rule. And so it's going to be difficult, I think, for everybody. If I could comment a little bit about the our viewpoint of it being a state-only rule. One of the reasons that we think that is, obviously, North Dakota is requiring less reductions than the other states. Number two, you've heard that most people think that it would be extremely complicated to have a regional program with another state, and we share that viewpoint. And a third reason is, obviously, the EPA, as you've heard, they just looked at what was within a state boundary when they put their program together. And so from a simplistic standpoint, and I certainly wouldn't want to speak for the regulators, but it's easier most likely to deal with what is within your state boundaries rather than a more complicated program with adjoining states. Having said that, we recognize that other companies have particular problems when it comes to where their wind energy is located versus where their loads are. And the EPA has, in conversations, indicated that they believe that there are other mechanisms that could be utilized other than a regional program to solve those particular issues. Now, they did not volunteer what that mechanism might be. And that may be a little self-serving on their part because when asked a question, one of their favorite responses is, well, that's in the state's hands. The state can solve that by working with their adjoining states, et cetera. So you don't get a lot of answers out of the EPA, and at times, depending upon when the question is asked, particularly concerning RECs and wind energy, you may get multiple answers, none of which are the same.
Scott Handy is also here, who I mentioned is our one of our distribution cooperative managers, so he really deals directly with those members at the end of the line. I think it'd be prudent to have a few comments from him as well.
Thank you, Stacy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I was not privy to the list of items that the Commission wanted to hear about today, so I guess I don't know if the perspective of the end consumer was one of those things, but that's what you're going to get if you allow me to proceed.
I didn't see that, Jerry.
You're the guy that's going to have to pay for this, is what it comes
to. Well, my members are, and they certainly are, have been, and will be willing to share their thoughts with me on that.
Just so that maybe everybody here already knows, but September 10th, the PSC is going to be at Cass County Electric having a symposium on this. So that'll be more of the same, but we've got Tony Clark coming in, and Julie's been taking the lead on who else you got going there?
NERC.
NERC's coming in to talk about the reliability and try to get more of the public awareness of just exactly what's coming down the pike. So you're all welcome to come that day, and they'll have really good cookies too. Right?
Great, and we appreciate the opportunity to host that, and I appreciate the opportunity for sort of an impromptu appearance here. As Stacy mentioned, my cooperative is one of 11 members that are part of the Minn Kota system. Having said that, I also need to tell you that my 41,000 members make up about a third of Minn Kota's total operation for in terms of what it sells to its members. So this means a great deal to us. Our wholesale rates over the last 10 years have gone from 3.25 cents a kilowatt hour to almost 7 cents a kilowatt hour. So what I'm going to say in the next minute or two, you know, keep that as your perspective here. The driver behind that what I think of as a pretty dramatic increase in wholesale power costs has almost entirely been the cost of emissions controls at the Young Station, as well as the cost of the wind contracts that Stacy mentioned are now a part of our portfolio. I'm not complaining about that, but I'm telling you that our retail members of the Minn Kota system have paid dearly for enhancing the environment over the last 10 years, and they will continue to do that. So when we look at the possible impacts of yet another layer of rules coming down the road that will impact those rates, we're a little sensitive about that, and we're kind of wondering if the retail consumers in North Dakota haven't already paid their fair share of environmental issues. And we could have a much, much longer discussion over what the environmental benefits would be of the 111D rules or not be, you know, depending on your perspective. We will acknowledge that the benefits of the $400+ million that Minn Kota has invested have been very good. We get a report annually that John produces of the emissions. We further break that down at Cass County Electric in emissions in terms of pounds per kilowatt hour that we sell to our members, and we actually publish that on our website. And I can tell you that of the five things that are on John's list, they are going, all those graphs are going down and to the right, including carbon dioxide because of the addition of wind to our portfolio. And this is on an intensity basis, just like the rule is. So when I say we're not necessarily complaining about making those investments, I am saying that that it has been painful, but they have had some very real environmental benefits, and we're proud of that. But again, I have to ask the question, and my members are asking the question, have we done enough? When, you know, how much is enough in terms of these sorts of investments? And again, looking at this coming down the road, we're very concerned about that. From my perspective, my operation is just a small piece of the industry. For reasons that I think are becoming apparent here, all the smart people migrate to the G&T and investor-owned level here, so the rest of us are left to run the distribution business. We really don't have any nexus to building blocks 1, 2, and 3. I mean, that all happens at the generation level. We do have nexus to building block number 4, energy efficiency, and I want to just make a brief comment about that. All the utilities, investor-owned cooperatives in North Dakota, have been champions for energy efficiency and conservation. I've been in the business for 32 years. It predates that by a long time. We don't need to apologize to anybody for being champions in that area. But the notion that we're somehow going to further change our consumers' behavior to the extent where they're going to reduce their energy consumption another 1.5% every year over year, I think is a fantasy. I mean, I can't get 500 people to show up for an annual meeting. How am I going to convince 41,000 people to make those conscious decisions regarding their energy use? And I'll further add that they don't want to use less energy. They want to use more because they understand the benefits of electricity and what electrical power has in their lives. So I put me down as a little skeptical about the ability to make a meaningful, measurable impact with building block number 4. And then just one final comment, and Commissioner Kalk and I chatted about this before the lunch break, but there's a particular genius, I think, in this building block approach and the implied flexibility that EPA has built into this. And as I think about that, I want to reframe the flexibility in a little analogy. What the EPA is really saying here is that, you know what, think of this as a hanging. We have 4 ropes, and you can choose all of them. You can choose any combination. You can choose any one of them, or you can bring your own rope. But there's still going to be a hanging at noon. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Scott, have you had a chance to talk with the Orman Code either way about what your rate impact to this could be? Because we heard from Otter Tail, we heard from MDU, and Excel kind of sort of gave us some numbers, but do you have?
We have not, and in fact, because of the complexity of the rule and because, frankly, of where North Dakota is positioned on the list, we want to make sure that when we do comment, it is done in a, I'm speaking now just from my perspective, not my colleagues at the table here. We want to make sure that our comments are based on a sound rationale for how it would play out for our members, and we frankly don't yet really know what that would be. As Stacy mentioned, our National Association is working hard on that. They have to date, I think, come out probably stronger in opposition to this than what we're willing to do at this point in time. Now, we'll likely end up, you know, being fairly opposed to this, but when we get there, I want to make sure that we've got some very good talking points backing that up. I am very confident in our National Association's ability to do this because the guy that's heading this up is a Fargo native, so they clearly have their best and brightest working on it.
I think the president, as Stacy had indicated earlier, we're still trying to assess those impacts. The plant is looking at building block 1 intensely and what those costs might be for what improvement could potentially be there. And that's at a 10,000-foot level. We're looking at utilizing that information and trying to figure out how much additional wind energy might needed to be put on the system and what that cost might be. And so we're working very hard looking at all these factors to try and come up with what that range of potential costs might be so that our board of directors can be aware of that and obviously the member co-ops as well.
It would seem like reliability would be a bigger concern for you guys than maybe the investor owns, just because in your area you don't have a lot of alternatives. You don't have a lot of gas out there. If you have to shut down coal, you're in a mess. Your liability challenges, I would off the cuff, seem like they might be bigger.
Well, we don't have gas, but, you can maybe do anything if you want to pay enough money for it. I mean, we did put somebody on the moon. This doesn't cost as much as that, but
I bet if you penciled it out, when we put that first mission on the moon, it probably costs less than what you'll spend.
I wouldn't dispute that.
So just to put that number out there.
Yeah, but I guess the point is, it's going to be costly. We don't know exactly what those costs are going to be.
I think some of the, as we shape this to the public, some are going to hear, this is the old people just standing up for coal, blah, 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 blah. But they have to understand, I think, that there's a reliability component to this. This is the first step in. It'll be coal, it'll be gas, and it's not going to be there when you need it. That's the part, the reliability. I think we should all focus on that as much as we are on cost.
Right. Some of the comments that other utilities that have made that happen to have, let's say, natural gas combined cycle plants in other parts of the country, a lot of them do not have firm gas supplies. And in order for them to operate at a 70% capacity factor, they're going to need those firm gas supplies. And so that's not only does this impact the utility industry, but it is also has a potentially large impact on the natural gas supply and transmission industry to revamp their systems in order to be able to supply the volumes of gas on a firm capacity that facilities might need in the future.
We all know how easy it is to site a pipeline in most states. So that's going to be, I'm sure, a real fast action accomplished. We like pipelines in North Dakota, but a lot of other states don't.
True.
Scott, even though your hanging analogy made such a perfect ending to the discussion on building block 4, I want to go back a little bit where I thought you were going originally, that building block. If we were to write a SIP and carry this all out, what do you and the rest of the North Dakota cooperatives and the national cooperatives think of state public utility commissions imposing demand-side energy efficiency policies on co-ops? We've never done that kind of thing before. I'm sure it would probably take legislation, and I'm guessing you would fill the buses and and make that point known.
Well, that's a great question, Commissioner. And in my mind, I break demand management into two components, energy and demand. We have been in the demand side of that for 30-plus years within the Minn Kota system. And everybody in the room is doing some version of that, where we aren't focused on reducing the total amount of energy used, which is what Building Block 4 is about. What we focus on is when is that energy used and shifting it into less costly times when more capacity at less cost is available. And in my mind, that is a far greater shift or an increase in efficiency than just simply an overall reduction. Our industry is all about improving our load factor. If you can make your resources work a higher percentage of the time, you're more efficient. And that's what time-shifting energy use is about. And we, all of us in the room, have done a superb job of that over many decades. Now, when you get on the energy side of it, just an overall reduction of that, that has a much greater impact on consumer behavior. You have to get them to do things differently, whether that's buying different light bulbs, getting them to purchase Energy Star appliances. Those are all very good things, but we are wholly dependent on their response, their behavior, and influencing a person's behavior, especially en masse, is a very difficult thing. Minnesota has had a SIP, and in that context, that's conservation improvement. That's not state implementation. And I frankly don't know how it's working. I know that Minn Kota has staff dedicated to running that program and filing the reports. My guess is that there's probably a fair amount of fiction in those reports, just because those things are really, really hard to measure. We will, if that is part of the state implementation plan, we'll do our level best to help craft that in terms of what can be done realistically, and especially how can it be measured in a way that has some credibility.
But it's one thing to work on it, but if Mary Jo is right that our state renewable energy objective would not be good enough for EPA, that it would require a mandate with penalty provisions, then I'm assuming the demand-side energy efficiency would require the same thing, that we would need to impose on you certain mandates with penalty provisions, and that would be quite a change for the distribution cooperatives to be regulated by us that way. What would be the reaction, do you think?
Well, having participated in the legislative and regulatory environment in this state for over 20 years, I have my own opinion on how likely it is for those mandates to appear, but that would be a change. But if that's the path that the state takes, regardless of how we might feel about it, we will do our best to help craft a reasonable, credible plan to do that. Sure.
Earlier you heard Tom mentioned that this was a different regulation than what they have done before, and that's so very true. This is a completely different paradigm than what the regulated community has dealt with or the regulators have dealt with. At the federal level, the EPA really only has authority to deal with Building Block 1. Building Blocks 2 through 3, they don't have that federal authority anywhere. So consequently, it's up to the states, if you will, to deal with all four of those building blocks. And if they utilize all of those building blocks that has been mentioned before and they put them into the SIP, they have to be federally enforceable, and consequently, then the EPA would have authority in those areas by virtue of the fact of being able to enforce that SIP. So that's something, again, that we've never seen before. And so, that in itself, I think a great many people have concern with, as they should. And I know many states have asked the EPA what a FIP will look like, and to date, at least to my knowledge, there has not been a response there, and I believe North Dakota has asked the same question, and I think one of the reasons that the EPA hasn't provided that answer is because they only have authority to deal with Building Block 1. Well, that's right. But Building Block 1 is they've figured 6% energy efficiency improvement at the plants. Well, they do deal with the air permits for the plants, so they have access, so to speak. There, they may not mandate a 6% improvement, but they can mandate an emission rate from the plant. So by virtue of that particular item, they would have authority there through the state. But the other building blocks 2, 3, and 4, they don't have that authority right now, unless the state basically gives them that through by including those building blocks in their SIP, and then they would become federally enforceable.
Okay, Julie and Paul?
I just want to thank Scott for being here and sharing your comments as well with the Minn Kota team. But also, I went to a lot of co-op meetings this spring and summer, and I really appreciated the extra effort that I saw at every single meeting to educate the participants about this issue. It was really well done, and I think, unfortunately, there was way too little of that for the last 5 years, and here we are. We have been dealt a mess, and now we have to figure out how to clean it up. So I encourage you to keep at it. I think people responded well, from what I could tell, to the presentation. So thanks for doing that.
All right, Randy, you think? Good. Dave? All right, thank you all. Well, let's do this. Let's take a quick 10-minute break, and then we'll finish up with Basin. Sound good?
Dale can clean up.
Dale, you can clean up it all.